Good morning, church. I was going to joke with you and say, are you feeling the nice cool air? That's good. All right, see, I knew it was just a mind over matter here. We're waiting. Keep praying. There was a couple who only after a few years of marriage started to have many disagreements and arguments. And as the months went by, things were getting really bad, and so they decided to try counseling. They met the counselor at the end of his day, which was filled with one bad marriage after another. But as they entered his office, it was apparent that this couple's situation would be the worst he had seen all day. The husband slumped in his chair, assumed a defeated position. He stared down at the floor, barely able to even manage a shrug of the shoulders. He had absolutely nothing to say. The counselor opened things up by asking what seems to be the problem. And immediately the wife launched into describing everything that was wrong with their marriage, talking 90 miles an hour. After 15 minutes of listening to her talk nonstop, the counselor had heard enough. So the counselor got out of his chair. He walked over to the wife, and while she was still talking in mid-sentence, the counselor gave her a great big hug and gave her a kiss and then sat back down. It's a technique I would not recommend. But the wife sat there in stunned silence. The counselor looked over at her husband, who sat there staring in disbelief. The counselor then said to the husband, "Now listen to me. Your wife needs that at least twice a week, every single week. You hear me? She needs that twice a week." The husband blinked and scratched his head, and he said, "Well," he replied, I guess I could bring her here on Tuesdays and Thursdays." I think he missed the point. And I think their marriage just went from bad to worse. And it contributed to what was already a very bad day for a stressed marriage counselor. But let me ask you, have you ever had one of those days that started out bad and only got worse as the day wore on? Have you ever had one of those days that did not go as you had planned? Have you ever had your hopes of something being better squashed? Well, as we continue in our travels with Moses in our summer sermon series, we look at one of those days that rapidly declined from bad to worse. Turn to me in your Bibles if you haven't already to Exodus chapter 5. Exodus chapter 5. Now, as you're turning there, we're going to be looking at this passage in a moment, but we left off last time with Moses reluctantly accepting God's mission, and that God uses reluctant leaders all the time. Well, God allows Aaron to join with Moses to carry out the task of delivering the Israelites out of their bondage in Egypt to the land God had promised for them. And the end of chapter 4 informs us that Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites. They just let them in on what God had said to them and supported all that by performing signs. And then we come to verse 31 of chapter 4. And I want us to just read that verse before getting into our passage this morning, Exodus 5, because it really sets things up for us today. Exodus 4, verse 31. It says, "And they," mean the Israelites, "they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them, had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshiped." Now, for the first time in 400 years, hope was in the air. Just maybe their lives would change. Just maybe they would be delivered. The people have hope. God is about to move. God is going to show up. And chapter 4 ends on a good note. So far, so good. Things are going well. We then come to chapter 5. Now, the three major players in the story, there's Moses, and I'm lumping Aaron with Moses, is Moses, and then there's Pharaoh, and there's God. And to help us really get our minds around this true account, I've outlined this narrative, this true story, around five words. Five words: demand, denial, deterioration, disappointment, dependence. All right, let's look at our first word. It's demand. Demand. Chapter 5, verse 1, it says, afterward. So fresh off of a high from the positive response of the Israelite leaders, afterward, Moses, it says there in verse 1, and Aaron, they went to Pharaoh and they said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the desert. Now, Moses and Aaron walk up to the most powerful man in the world at that time and demand the release of the slaves. The man, Moses, who once ran away in fear from a snake, is now standing fearless in the presence of the great and powerful Pharaoh. And you have to wonder, at least I do, how is it that Moses and Aaron were allowed in the king's presence to even have this discussion with him in the first place? Was it because of Moses' past connections with the Egyptian court of those 40 years he grew up as son of Pharaoh's daughter? Well, this would be a different Pharaoh than those days, for that Pharaoh had passed away. But perhaps Moses still had friends in high places. Or just maybe the king simply had this open door policy, but whatever the reason might be, they got in. And they speak confidently, they speak boldly, they speak authoritatively as they follow the script given to them by God. They just received, as we read in chapter 4, verse 31, a favorable response from the Israelites, and perhaps they just might have been thinking right about now, this is going to be a slam dunk. It was good back here. We're going to go talk to Pharaoh. He's going to go along with us, and here we go. And if necessary, Moses could blow them away with a few miraculous signs if he needed to. So Moses and Aaron boldly demand that Pharaoh let God's people go. Moses says what God told him to say, almost verbatim, let my people go. And Pharaoh says in verse 2, notice here, verse 2, Pharaoh says, in your dreams. Loose translation. It's not exactly what it says. We're going to come back to Pharaoh's denial here in verse 2 in a moment. But the bell sounds, round one is over. No way, Jose, you're not going. Now, credit to Moses here. He stood his ground. I won't back down. No, I won't back down. I'll stand my ground. I won't back down. Moses did not back down. He goes back into the ring for round two. Now, this time, Moses adds a little force to it. Notice here, verse 3. The God of the Hebrews has met us, which is literally, that is saying, the God of the Hebrews is on our side. They continue. Now, let us take a three-day journey. Underline that. We'll come back to that in a moment. Let us take a three-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with a sword. Now, there's some debate as to what Moses is saying about this three-day journey. I mean, certainly, the intention is not to go on a three-day retreat, but to be gone for good, right? So what's going on here? Is Moses shading the truth a little bit? Is he not really being entirely truthful? I mean, if he let them go, they weren't coming back. What's this three-day deal? Well, as I've argued before, a dictator, an evil man like Pharaoh, has no right to the truth. And I personally wouldn't have a real problem, if that's what Moses is doing here, and speaking of a three-day journey only. But what I think is going on here is more than that. I think God was giving Pharaoh a test. Would Pharaoh even allow Israel to serve and worship God for 3 days? Now, there's some evidence in non-biblical sources that Egyptian slaves were sometimes given time off to worship their gods. So asking for 3 days to worship their god was a reasonable request here that the king would often honor. But it's really not a request, is it? It's not even a suggestion. It's a demand. It's a simple declaration. Pharaoh, let the Hebrews go. They're not asking. They're demanding. And that just might be what sets Pharaoh off here. The demand was daring and bold, but we come to what was even more daring and bold, the denial. A second word this morning, denial. Denial. Pharaoh said, verse 2, who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. Now, this response shouldn't have come as a total surprise to Moses, because when God first gave the assignment to Moses back in chapter 3, God had said that the king would not listen. But Pharaoh's choice of words here is quite telling of his heart. Verse 2 is one of the most important verses in this chapter. I would even say it introduces us to one of the major themes of the entire book of Exodus. Wrapped up in that one question, who is the Lord, is the heart of Exodus. And God will now go through great lengths to answer that question. Who's the Lord? I'll show you who's Lord. And he's going to prove that he is the supreme deity who alone has the right to demand praise and anything else he wants from every one of his creatures. God's going to indeed answer that question, who is the Lord? And show Pharaoh that he is a God not to be trifled with. And by the time the Israelites exit Egypt and crossing the Red Sea, Pharaoh will unmistakably encounter the identity of this God he is ignorant of. When all is said and done, Pharaoh will know who the Lord is. Maybe not in a personal way, but he's going to find out. You want to ask who the Lord is? I'll show you. Who's the Lord? Who's the Lord? That's really a question of our day. Who's the Lord? And all that's going on in the world around us, the central problem we have as a culture that has lost its way is because we do not know the Lord. Our central problem, church, our central problem is not having the right president or the right climate change solution. The central problem is not to fix education or to have a stronger military. I mean, you can think through how important those and other issues might be, but this we do know: there is one true living God who is not worshipped today. That's absolutely, we see that all the time. And many are wandering aimlessly asking, who's the Lord? Who is the Lord? Kind of like when I mentioned to some young people about Larry Bird, and they go, Larry who? Now, I know I'm old, but you kidding me? Larry who? Now, much more significant than that is this issue of ignorance about God. People saying, who's this Lord? It's the question we all must answer. Do you know the Lord? Do you know the Lord? I'm not asking, were you raised to go to church? Do you know the Lord? I'm not asking, are you interested in spiritual dimension? Do you know the Lord? I'm not asking, have you heard about God, or do you enjoy Christmas carols or hymns or listening to Air One? No, no. Do you know the Lord? Do you care to know him? And sadly, many people have rejected the God they think they know, but it isn't the God of the Bible. I'm not sure who said it, but it's kind of stuck with me. Tell me about the God you don't believe in, because I may not believe in that God either. Do you know the Lord? Yahweh God, as he made himself known in his word. Is that the God you know? Is it just something you've conjured up in your own mind, or other people have told you who he is? Do you know this God of this Bible? Pharaoh was ignorant of God's identity, and he had no interest in knowing this God. He didn't want a God. He didn't need a God because he saw himself as a God. Pharaoh was considered a God in his land. He was worshipped. He had statues of him that towered into the skies. You didn't mess with Pharaoh. I'm the God of this land, he would say. I make the rules. I am the one in control. And Pharaoh had set himself up in place of God. And he says, I don't have to listen to this God of yours. See, the contest is really about whom you will listen to and worship. And not only does Pharaoh deny their request, he makes their oppression even more severe, if that was even possible. He does. Verse 4, the king of Egypt said, Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to work. And then Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now numerous, and you're stopping them from working. And things go from bad to worse for the people of God. We come to our third word, deterioration. Deterioration. We see Pharaoh taking out his frustration on the Israelites. Verse 6. That same day. Does that jump out to you? That same day. This is all happening within a 24-hour period. I mean, it's a pretty bad day. That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and foremen in charge of the people. You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw. Or require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy. That's why they're crying out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Now, brick making was an important industry in ancient Egypt. The Egyptians used bricks for all kinds of buildings, temples and storehouses and palaces and other official residences and so on. And straw was essential to the brick-making process, for it reinforced the clay and helped each brick stay intact. Now, to this point, for these Israelite slaves, the straw was delivered to them. But from now on, the people are going to have to go and find their own straw, but they had to produce the same number of bricks. And this is just completely irrational. It makes no sense to expect that the Hebrews could keep meeting their quota without the resources to get the job done. But see, if you're a tyrant, you make rash decisions. And if you're a tyrant making rash decisions, you really don't think through what those decisions will mean on all the poor souls who have to put up with you. Pharaoh wasn't done. Look at verse 9. Make the work harder for the men so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies. Pharaoh's saying he's going to make their lives even more miserable. And then we have the slave drivers and the foremen. The next verse is out here. That they had to go and be the ones to pass the word along to the Israelites of this new arrangement. Now, how would you like to be the one to deliver that news? I mean, it isn't even this, I've got good news and I've got bad news. No, it's I've got bad news and I've got worse news. Keep making the bricks, but there has been a change. Straw will no longer come to you. You will have to go and get your straw yourself. Bad news. Oh, it's even worse than that. It's expected that you will make as many as bricks as before. See, Pharaoh is trying to crush their hopes and cause doubts in their minds. It gets worse. Verse 14 informs us that when the inevitable happens, the people are not able to meet their quota. The foremen are punished. They are severely beaten, it says. Now, Pharaoh's labor force was organized with the Egyptian bosses, the slave masters, they were at the top. And then the Hebrew managers, the foremen, they were in the middle. And then the rest of the Hebrew slaves, they were at the bottom. Nothing happens to the slave masters at the top because they were Egyptians. And Pharaoh's defiance toward the God of Israel is taken out on the Israelites. And this is a dreadful turn of events. God was concerned. We saw that at the end of chapter 4. God was concerned about them. He had seen their misery. God was going to deliver them from this horrible oppression. Things were about to get better for the people of God. That's how chapter 4 ended. And we go, well, now this. What is going on here? I mean, it's kind of as if we're reading the wrong chapter. I thought God was on the move. I thought he was going to show up. This is not going as they had planned. This is not going as we would have expected. It's a terrible, very bad day. And I couldn't help but think of the kid's book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Just kind of how my mind works. Alexander says, I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. And when I got out of bed, I tripped over my skateboard, and by mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink while the water was running, and I could tell that it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. He goes on to say he had a rotten day at school, he had a painful visit to the dentist, and then things don't get any better that evening. He says, we had lima beans for dinner. I hate lima beans. There was kissing on TV. I hate kissing on TV. My bath was too hot. I got soap in my eyes. My marble went down the drain, and I had to wear my railroad train pajamas, and I hate my railroad train pajamas. It's been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Now, I suppose for a seven-year-old, that's pretty awful. But do you know the feeling? Do you know the feeling? Everything you seem to touch on a certain day, it just goes bad. You go, I don't want to touch another thing. This is a terrible day. It's getting worse. I mean, have you ever had one of those days? Maybe you feel like you're having that kind of story. That's kind of the story of your life right now. Everything's kind of going from bad to worse. I mean, life can be so downright maddening at times. Someone telling you to cheer up isn't very helpful. Might feel like the guy who was told, cheer up, things could get worse. And sure enough, I cheered up and things got worse, right? And you go, yeah, that's my life. Yep, I'm living it. For the Israelites, things got worse. They must have been wondering, what's going on here? Why in the world is this happening? What have we done wrong? What has changed? And suddenly the light bulb goes on. The people were being punished and severely mistreated, and they know whom to blame. We come to our fourth word this morning, disappointment. Disappointment. Chapter 5, verse 19 says, the Israelite foremen realized they were in trouble when they were told, you are not to reduce the number of bricks required of you for each day. Now, what do you do when you realize the situation just got worse? What do? You look to blame someone. And unfortunately, at times, the best target are leaders. Verse 20, when they, the foremen, left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them. And they said, may the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. Now, the foremen have barely been able to kind of just lick at their wounds and from the severe beating when they happen to run into Moses and Aaron. I mean, you talk about, for Moses and Aaron, they're being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But there seems to be more to this than that. I'm not sure that it just happened that they bumped into Moses and Aaron. There seems to be, at least my understanding of this, there seems to be more intentional than that just going on here. That you have the foreman on the one side of things, and you have Moses and Aaron over here. One group seems to be waiting for the other group. And there's more than one way to translate this sentence. They met Moses and Aaron who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. We really don't know who the subject is in the original. You can translate this as either Moses and Aaron were waiting for the foreman, and them foremen come out. They think they might give them good news. They give them a tongue lashing. Or the foremen were waiting for Moses and Aaron. That's kind of how I take this. Because when it says that the foreman met Moses and Aaron, the word for met there could be translated attacked. It could read then, the foremen were waiting to pounce on Moses and Aaron. However it should be translated, one thing's for sure, the foremen were quite verbally abusive. They vented their anger and frustration on Moses and Aaron. They use a strong language here when they say, may the Lord look upon you and judge you. Literally, that means, may God look upon what you have done and punish you. May God render justice for what you guys have done, because Moses and Aaron, this is all your fault. This is all your fault. You have made things worse. How in the world could you do this to us? And the foremen were right. From a human perspective, the plan is completely backfired. The hope they had is all gone, and whether or not it was Pharaoh's intention, he has successfully driven a wedge between the leaders, Moses and Aaron, and the people. Driven this wedge. The very people that Moses has wanted to help for over 40 years were now blaming him for their troubles. I mean, it's bad enough that Pharaoh was digging in his heels, but now Moses' own people are turning on him. They're blaming him for how things are turning out. And Moses had to be thinking right here, I never wanted this leadership position in the first place. Now this, as has been said, a good leader takes a little more than his share of the blame and a little less than his share of the credit. When you go, who then in his or her right mind would want to be a leader? Because as you likely already know, because most if not all of us in this room are a leader in one way or another because we're people of influence, at least we ought to be. And you already know that as a leader, at times it can be rather lonely there. You know the saying in Washington, D.C., if you want a friend, get a dog. That's it. That's your friend. See, as a leader, as a person of influence, there are going to be those times that you are misunderstood. There will be those times you felt you did the right thing and you even did it the right way, and yet you feel the pain of someone misjudging you and even turning against you, and it hurts. It's an understatement, really. Some have packed it in, so I never want to be a leader again. I just read this past week that a good leader will, in time, disappoint everyone. That's encouraging. Anybody want to sign up for a leader? But listen, this is why we cannot live or die by the way others judge us. This is why, I want us to get this, this is why that it's critical that our identity is not in what we do or how we perform. Former pro soccer star Landon Donovan was the standard bearer of American soccer for more than a decade. And when Donovan was growing up in California, he had this t-shirt that said, soccer is life, the rest is just details. Well, a few years ago now, Donovan admitted, soccer was my identity. But in the last stage of his career, that identity started to crack. From 2012 to 2013, Donovan struggled with depression. He watched his celebrity marriage disintegrate, and he was forced to take a four-month break from soccer. You see, the pressure to perform and keep pleasing fans and coaches became too much. And Donovan said, fans, coaches, and the media want us to live, breathe, eat, and die the sport. Every game, they want you to go out and do everything you can to make the fans feel good, make the coach feel successful, make the owners successful. He says, after the 2006 World Cup, I realized clearly that it was a business and that it was fickle. He says, I was foolish enough to think that these people who were showing me so much love genuinely liked me. But after the 2006 World Cup, people said, now you had a bad World Cup. We don't think you're that cool anymore. He says, that for me was a very eye-opening experience, and it made me very sad. And it led to his depression. But then he adds this. At the time, it was by far the hardest thing that ever happened to me in my life. But the beauty is, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, and it allowed me to wake up and see the world differently for the first time. Now, if Moses was ever on a pedestal, he's just fallen off. It may be one of the hardest things he will ever go through, but one of the best things as well. Because this crisis of disappointing others, I want us to see this. This is God making of a leader here. This crisis of disappointing others is God making of a leader who will not be driven by the need to secure the approval of others. I don't have that down yet. I don't know if you do. I don't have that down yet. The crisis of disappointing others, God making of a leader who will not be driven by the need to secure the approval of others. And for Moses, the wheels of the bus are falling off. People are disappointed with him. Now what is he going to do? What are we to do in those moments of rejection when people turn against us, when things don't make sense, when you did what you were supposed to do and things did not turn out as expected? Here's our fifth word this morning, dependence. Dependence. Where does he go with his own disappointment, his own disillusionment? Verse 22, five key words here. Moses returned to the Lord. That's where we have to go. He returned to the Lord. He had no one but God. He doesn't run to the bottle. He doesn't run to other escapes. He goes to God with his pain, with his disappointment, and with his frustration. You see, when the bottom falls out, church, what do you run to? Do you run to the bottle? Or do you run to check out those websites? Do you get all defensive? Do you turn to whatever your drug of choice might be? No. Moses says here, verse 22 continues, O Lord, why have you brought trouble? The word means evil. Why have you brought evil upon this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's brought trouble upon this people, and you have not rescued your people at all. You see it? Moses is alone with God. He is frustrated. God is not doing what he said he was going to do. And he asks, why God? Have you ever asked that question? Why God? Twofold disappointment here. Rejection from Pharaoh, and he's angry with how God is handling things, how God is handling his life. And if we're honest, we can think of times we're greatly disappointed with God, where we say, God, this is not okay. This isn't making any sense. Moses is in a season when things don't make sense. And Moses is saying here, this is why it's just crazy stuff for him right now. I did what you asked me to do, Lord. Moses was being obedient. But God's doing something else in Moses. He's making him dependent. I believe it is possible to be obedient, yet not dependent. God is not only after obedience, he is after dependence. And when things go from bad to worse, it forces dependence. And it's right here, church, that the battle is either won or lost. It is right here when everything inside of us wants to look for a shortcut, or we want to retaliate in kind, or we want to take our frustration out on someone, and or we want to play the blame game, that it's right then that we must look for the better way, trust God no matter what, that when things go from bad to worse, through it all, God is doing what is best. Now I want to circle around to the key question, the central question, verse 2, who is the Lord? We have to answer that. Who is the Lord? Who's in charge? Who is in charge of your life? Is God trustworthy? I mean, who's the Lord? And is he the God of the Bible? Is he one in whom you can place your dependence? You see, through the shattered dreams, when you come to the end of your rope, you got to allow it to deepen your relationship with God, that you're more dependent upon him. Because in those seasons, you have to trust in what you know to be true of God. It's been said, never doubt in the dark what God has told you in the light. See, it's a question of who is the Lord. That matters. You asking God why? Why, God? Are you in an Exodus 5, 22 and 23 moment right now? Well, what do you do when the God you think you know acts in a way that is inconsistent with your present reality? Can you trust God when he doesn't fit your expectations? What do you do in those moments? Well, this is what we must do. When you're in a season of disappointment, embrace your theology. Embrace your theology. Because in those moments, it is not God who's failing us, but our theology of God that is failing us. And there's a difference between those two. How do you make it in these seasons? You lean on your theology. What does that mean? Well, in the times of pain and you have to know in those times of disappointment, rejection, whatever it might be, that God is sovereign, that he is in control, that he is God, that he brings us to those places where we have to walk our theology out. See, circumstances that don't make sense drive us to dependence. When things go from bad to worse, through it all, God is doing what is best. Are you disappointed right now? Are you at the end of your rope? You know what to turn to? Well, when I think of someone who was at the end of his rope, I think of the English poet William Cowper, who found himself so deep in discouragement that he tried to end it all, end his life, by drinking poison. But God intervened, graciously led someone to find him, his stomach was pumped, and he was delivered. Not soon after that, William Cowper hired this coach to take him down to the Thames River, and where he intended to plunge himself into the dark, swirling waters. Well, the driver of that coach would have none of it. He restrained Cowper, got him back in the coach, and drove him home. Once again, Cowper found himself in despair, and he found this knife in the privacy of his home, and he attempted to fall on it, but you know what happened? The blade broke. Still not deterred, the despairing poet rigged up a rope in his basement, but someone found him before he strangled himself and took him down. Finally, in the gravity of his sorrow, he plunged himself into the depths of the book of Romans. It was in his reading of the book of Romans that one particular passage just brought him to his knees. He was in great despair, and to turning to all those other things, he finally turned to the Lord and he put his faith in Jesus Christ. Years later, he penned this very familiar hymn: God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and he rides upon the storm. Deep and unfathomable minds of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and he works his sovereign will. In despair, end of your rope, you're dealing with just some disappointment right now, let it drive you to your knees to greater dependence upon God, because he doesn't want just obedience, he wants dependence. Can you believe that through it all is the God who sovereignly is working out his perfect will? Can you trust him with your disappointment? Can you? With your disillusionment, can you trust him?